Thank you, Fiona, and thanks, Jesse, for asking me to come along tonight. You're absolutely right. I am a strong supporter of AA and believe it plays a very important part, along with Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, in helping people through recovery. Tonight I'm going to place my emphasis, as this is a Vicky Parr meeting, mainly on the effects on young people. On another day I'll talk about golden oldie site myself. There's some recently new research that shows just how dangerous alcohol can be to young brains, and we will mention part of that. So next one, please. Thank you. This is sort of an outline of what I need to talk about. Give you a bit of a background idea of actually how the brain develops, because we've discovered that it doesn't all stop when you're a small baby, it continues for a period of time. And then talk about the disease of alcoholism and the way in which the brain may be affected in that situation. So if we look about, first of all, that the first 2 years of life, there's rapid growth of brain connections. In a way, the brain's a bit like a sponge. I was just astounded at my grandchildren at how rapidly they pick things up. And at the age of four, one of my grandsons was able to tell his father how to get from A to B. He'd only ever done it in the reverse direction in the dark some several weeks before. So it's just astounding how much they pick up and what they observe around them. Round about the age of six, all these connections start to be pruned. And this is part of what we might call the specialisation. And it's based on the fact that the connections that are no longer used are pruned off, just the same as we would prune a fruit tree. And those that are there are more highly developed. So that sort of the basic functions of our senses of smell, taste, hearing, etc., they develop strongly, and our balance and movement during that period of time, and also gradually language skills start to mature. If you want to learn a foreign language, in fact, it's much better to learn it before about the age of 10 or 11. You're far more flexible and far more able to do that. Around about the age of 11 or 12, there's another growth spurt. This is fairly new information. We didn't realise that this actually happened. We knew the brain kept maturing, but we didn't know that it was a growth spurt. And during that period of teenage time, there's another pruning that occurs. And so that the implications of this I will talk about in a moment. Around about the age of 13 or 14, is what we call the reward centre of our brain is fully developed. And that's not surprising when you hear teenagers say, I want, I need, I have to have. That's fairly standard sort of stuff. And often they confuse wants and needs, don't they? I need such and such when they really mean I want such and such. Fine, thank you. Now over about a 10-year period, from roughly about 14, 15 through to about 24, 25, the maturation process continues, and now things like reasoning and problem solving start to occur. In fact, we probably ask people who enter university far too early. We should let them wait a little bit later till their brains are a little more mature. And the brain centre then starts to integrate these senses that were developed as a young child now with the emotions, with reasoning and with planning. And this planning is often called the executive function. We always think in a big organisation, the executives are the important people. Certainly they get paid more money than anyone else, but that's perhaps one of the reasons why it's called an executive function. And this matures by about the mid-20s. And the way this is done is a little bit like the insulation around electrical wiring. It starts to wrap up those particular pathways that it wants to keep and insulate them and make them much stronger. So think about that. Reward centres mature by 15, mature centres 10 years later. I've heard somebody once describe a normal standard teenager as a motor vehicle with a turbocharged engine and a set of dodgy brakes. I'll come back to that later. Now, there are a whole variety of different ways of looking at the disease of addiction, and all of these are quite relevant, actually. The first important thing is that it is a chronic relapsing disease of the brain involving things like reward, motivation and memory. So just the same as asthma is a chronic relapsing disease of the lungs, and that we expect people to have another attack if they don't look after themselves, exactly the same thing happens with addiction. Addiction is also a learned behaviour. The brain learns, wow, this is great stuff. If I just take it, I can feel a heck of a lot better than what I felt before. That's the immediate effect, of course. That's not when it starts biting you on the tail several years down the track. It also may be considered as an imbalance between this overactive reward system and this dampened underactive control system, so that even when we're no longer teenagers and we are adults, there's still the problem of how do we keep these two things in balance. And in a mature, responsible person, they tend to be in balance, but you can see how easily they can get out of balance. And lastly, of course, it's a hypersensitivity. Now, I've heard the word allergy. Strictly scientifically speaking, that's not right. The allergy involves the immune system, but like allergic problems, it's a hypersensitivity of the receptors in the brain to alcohol. So once you become addicted, now you don't need as much as you need before to get into strife very, very rapidly and start the whole process going. I don't have to tell you that, you know that. So there's about four different ways that we might consider. Now the next thing is to find what happens actually in our brain when we develop this disease. And if we think of any disease, it's a situation where we start with a normal organ, brain in this situation, and either its structure or its function or both are changed. Understand that? See, some people think, well, you know, if I'm sick, all I've got to do is get an X-ray and I'll find out. But your function can be altered without the structure actually being altered. Broken leg, it's pretty easy to understand, isn't it? Both the structure and the function are altered. But many of our internal problems, and certainly in our brain, it starts with functional problems. So an individual who can have a disease for some time before they actually become ill. And ill is what you feel. So, I mean, cancer is a classic. Most people who develop cancer have had the disease for maybe 5 to 10 years before they actually become ill. It's just slowly been growing over a period of time. And asthma, I think we can understand fairly easily as people that may well have been born with a normal set of lungs. They then become hypersensitive. Sometimes it's to pollen, sometimes it's to food. The classic one, of course, is peanuts. And we worry if our child has an allergy to that because it can be overwhelming and it can actually kill you. Right. Next one, thanks. So let's then look at what are the changes in the brain as this disease develops. Well, mainly they're changes in function. And the first one is that the brain receptors become more sensitive to alcohol. They release a large amount of this hormone called dopamine, which is really the pleasure chemical. And this causes a feeling of pleasure. And therefore, that's a situation, often very early in use, where people are using alcohol to reward themselves in order to get that high. Now, of course, as time goes by, it's a bit like working in a factory where you've been working too hard and the quality control goes off. Those receptors just can't keep that up. They become less sensitive, and now you require more alcohol to get the same sort of effect in order to bring those dopamine levels not up to the high level, but just even to a normal sort of level. And then, of course, you're using alcohol for relief. And during one's life, somebody one day may be using it for reward, another day using it for relief. But certainly when you're well down the track, it's pretty much all for relief. The reward is gone some time ago. Right, next one, thanks. Now, there's also, of course, changes that occur as the consequences. So not just the changes due to the disease, but the consequences. If you keep putting a toxin, a poison, into your system for many years, it's not all that surprising that your organs start to crumble. So the brain, first of all, decision-making becomes impaired, learning and memory become impaired, and eventually coordination of movement. I mean, the classic inability in the dark to be able to walk straight and to keep bumping into things is due to the fact that your balance centres have been in strife. Most people have heard of liver damage, and anyone that drinks enough will get a fatty liver. Further down the track, of course, cirrhosis, and that can be a cause of not only ill health, but death. Heart damage, the heart muscle. You know, the poets talk of wonderful things that the heart does, but basically it's a pump. It's got to get blood to your brain, to your feet and everywhere else. Heart muscle starts to deteriorate, and the normal rhythm of your heart can be interfered with as well. Alcohol is also a risk factor for cancers, pretty much along the gut, in your gullet, in your liver and in your bowel, but for many other diseases as well. And a point that I've made down there is that this is a disease that kills you, that individuals with addiction to alcohol actually die at 3.5 times the rate of somebody of the same age in the community. 3.5 times. That's not something that I would particularly like to have to worry about. If we had the time, I could go on and tell you about 200 or 300 other diseases, but I don't think you need to know about that tonight. So having put that background to you, how do we recognise that there is a disease of addiction? And one of the ways of considering it is to look at it under these three headings. And this is a holistic way. See, some people sometimes think that the word disease is a nasty, dirty word. It sort of kind of means that, you know, you've got to have something chopped out and you're inevitably going to die. But I think the concept of looking at it in a holistic manner is, what are the physical or biological aspects we need to worry about? What about the psychological ones, and what about the social ones? I give them to you in that order, but of course most of you are often aware that the social problems occur much earlier than the other ones. So let's look at the biological ones first. First of all is the inherited risk. Now, people sometimes think, I'm a born an alcoholic and therefore that's it. Let me assure you, you are not born an alcoholic. There is no such thing as an alcohol gene. There's no such thing as an addiction gene. However, there are 6 genes at least that put you at increased risk. Right? So it's a little bit like increased risk of a variety of other things as well. But if you, it's like starting the world with a handicap. So yes, everyone, you can walk down the track, but you're going to have to carry 20 kilos, or you're going to carry 30 kilos, you're going to carry 40 kilos. So you can see that life could be much more of a strife. The key thing, I think, and really if we think about it, the hallmark of addiction is your impaired control over use. You go out with some friends, have a meal, have a few drinks, 10 o'clock everyone's ready to go home. But if you're an alcoholic, that's just the start, isn't it? Wow! And away we go. And that could be a good night or a bad night. Or as one of my patients once said to me, it wasn't the drinking, Doc, it was the sleeping. I was okay when I went to bed, I felt terrible when I woke up in the morning. That's another issue, isn't it? Now, gradually, of course, what happens is the control centres in the brain are dampened down and they actually go to sleep. Right? So now you're kind of turned into a teenager again. Not physically, but the fact that you've got these reward centres kicking over and the control centre, like Rip Van Winkle, is sound asleep and it's not going to do anything much. And the problem is that when you stop, it takes quite some time, months, maybe up to 1 or 2 years for the brain to fully wake up. So you can see why the risk of relapse is so high pretty soon after you stop, because here you've got a brain with the reward centres ticking over, give me more, give me more, give me more, and you've got a control centre that's gone to sleep. It's a little bit like having a sort of a football team and the forwards are working their insides out and the backs have all gone to sleep and they're just sort of sitting on the bench. You wouldn't get very far, would you? The other point, of course, is that organ damage occurs as a consequence physically, and that is going to take some time to repair once you stop. Right, next one, thanks. Right, let's look at the psychological aspects of addiction. The first one is that alcohol alters mood. I think everybody knows that. In fact, that's probably the main reason why people drink, is in order to alter their mood, to feel a little more comfortable in a social sort of setting. And alcohol, of course, is great for relieving anxiety and sort of blocking out those uncomfortable emotions. As the drinking, of course, increases and you become tolerant, then the relief's not adequate, is it? So he's got something that helped you with anxiety before, and now it often makes you depressed. And if you stop, you often become very anxious again. And that anxiety, of course, is part of withdrawal, or could be part of the original problem. In fact, social anxiety is a very common reason why people drink. And of course, if it persists and your drinking keeps going, you're going to get into strife. And one of the critical things in trying to turn around is having better ways of dealing with it. Your personality style is quite important as well. If you're impulsive, as to a certain extent most teenagers are, if your self-esteem is about as big as a 5-cent piece, if you have trouble sitting with your own emotions, and if you're a bit antisocial, these are all personality styles that are going to put you at very high risk. A mental illness, of course, and again, this is not your fault or anyone else's fault, but if you have a mental illness, if you have a depressive illness, totally unrelated, if you have a psychotic illness, you've got bipolar, then you don't need near as much alcohol to get into strife. So mental illness, as well as personality and as well as the inherited, boy, it's quite a few things, isn't it? However, you're only going to get there by actually drinking. And half the people who actually get into strife don't start with any major risks at all. It's just that they have continued to use for a whole variety of other reasons. Let's look at the social aspects. And this list could go on and on and on. As consumption increases, then social behaviour deteriorates. Maybe you were not aware of that when you were drinking, but I'm sure you're aware of your friends' social behaviour. Legal problems occur. The police don't seem to like people fighting or driving a car under the influence of alcohol. Work-related, the boss seems to think, you know, that you should be just as good on a Monday and Tuesday as you are on a Thursday and Friday for some strange reason. Learning and studying. So if you're a student, you know, your grades are going to go down. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Intimate relations get strained. I mean, why would you just get up and smile when somebody's given you hell? It's not surprising that conflict occurs within families and within intimate relationships. Sadly, domestic violence, well over half the problems of domestic violence are alcohol related. And social responsibilities are ignored. And the thing that I find over and over again is I've never met a good, ongoing, active alcoholic that still is involved with the same hobbies that they were involved with when they were much younger. And I think that's a very important clue that certain things have gone out of your life and alcohol has become the centre. Right, thank you. So, how do we respond to that? There's no good me telling you about all the problems if I don't give you some clue as to how you might respond. Well, the first one, of course, some people can just stop. Just like the Nike ad, they can just stop. However, the majority of individuals find that pretty tough. Remember, we're dealing with a chronic relapsing disease. So, let's look at the different headings of biological, psychological and social and see what we can do. Let's look at the biological now. Wonderful thing about being abstinent is that your body's organs can start to heal. And surprise, surprise, your memory starts to improve. And you're able to learn things that you couldn't learn before. The risk of alcohol-related illness goes down. So that 3.5 times dying goes down. And your tissues, your risk of cancer goes down. So there's a lot of very good things that happen when you become abstinent. There are medications that can be used to reduce your symptoms in withdrawal or reduce your cravings, if that's it. But they are not the answer. Now, anyone who thinks that there is a pill that's going to get rid of your alcoholism really should go back to school, because that just doesn't make any sense and it's not going to happen. But, of course, if you have a mental illness and that needs to be treated and that may require medication, and you may briefly require medication for your alcohol-related problems as well. Right, now let's look at the psychological responses. Coping skills are really the key that are needed to deal with stress and distress. No matter what happens to us in our life, we're going to come across stress, and at times it's going to be pretty severe. Life will change. The grey hairs, there's a few of them I notice in the audience like me, can remember when these wonderful mobile phones that these young people are flicking around just with not even a thought in somebody's head, right, Tom? And the hospitals, of course, didn't even have a paging system. I can go back that far, where they had to sort of chase you around to find you. Was it much easier to hide in those days? Anyhow, never mind. Cravings are something that often needs to be dealt with as well. These are best learned with the guidance of professionals. And if you get your general practitioner, if this is a problem for you, to refer you to the appropriate place. There's a whole variety of what we might call psychological or psychotherapeutic skills that you can learn to deal with a variety of these things. To deal with your anxiety, if that's a major problem. To deal with change in your life. Mental illness treatment I mentioned before. What about the social? Social, I think, is one of the most important things. One of the things I like about AA is you use the word responsibility and you use the word structure. And they're two very, very important things. You are not going to be able to control your disease, but you can control yourself and your life. So self-direction, you know, not having somebody else to determine what you're going to do and point you out, but learn to take the responsibility for your own actions, your own decisions, and know where you're going. I mean, that's normal for normal people, but it's critical in terms of recovery. Structure in your life. You don't have to know what you're going to do every 5 minutes of the day, but you do... Hi, Lenny. But you do need to... I've got friends here, see? But you do need to be able to get some structure back into your life. Otherwise, you're going to drift right back and your brain's going to go say, not too much to do. Let's go back to what we were doing before. Support. Support is absolutely critical. Sometimes it's very difficult to get support from your family because they say, I've heard that before. You said you were going to change. You never did. Why should I believe you this time? And I can understand that. Friends, important. I think that one of the really critical things about AA that it is a support group which should be non-judgmental, people who have gone through this before and can help. It's like the tour guide when you want to find out about this wonderful museum or this wonderful art gallery. You can do it by yourself and you can go for hours and then somebody will say, do you see such and such? And you say, no. So, you know, it often helps to have a tour guide, doesn't it? Now, a lot of the things that we need in support are things that maybe we hadn't been involved with for a while. Little things like, how do we manage our time? How do we manage our finances? Do we owe anybody money? Do we need to put something in place so that we can gradually repay those debts? Do we have a job? Do we need to study? Right? Is our accommodation stable? I mean, if you're going to be living on the street, pretty hard to get your head around a lot of these other things. What about nutrition? What about exercise? These are about things that have often been left, and to me, one of the critical things is hobbies. The most important thing about a hobby, and interesting when I talk about somebody thinks this means making sort of aeroplanes with bits of balsa wood. No, I don't mean that at all. My hobby is astronomy. And I'm learning something new every day, every night that it's clear and there's no cloud. And I find it fascinating. I go back and learn my physics. There's all sorts of things from way back which help my understanding of it. A hobby is something that you're passionate about, right? So it may be something you do with your hands, it may be something you do with your brain. But the critical thing is that if you like your hobby, time goes by and you just don't aware how much has happened. Mind you, make sure that that doesn't become the new obsession. Right, where we go. Which is always a risk, isn't it? Right, now let's try to wrap it up. There's a couple of things. One of the things that used to worry me was people say, well, if I've got a disease, I can't do anything about it and I'm not really responsible. Rubbish. having a disease, it doesn't matter whether it's addiction, whether it's depression, whether it's diabetes. Have you ever known a diabetic to get better just by injecting insulin? No way. They've got to be very careful about their diet. They've got to be very careful about exercise. There's a whole variety. They've got to be careful they don't stub their toe. If they do, they get it treated pretty quickly, because otherwise they're going to get gangrene and they could lose their foot. So, you know, any illness, it doesn't matter what it is, we do need to work on it. And we can't excuse ourselves from the responsibility to learn about our own disease and to learn how to do something about it. If we don't, the consequences are burdened for ourselves, for our family, and for the community as a whole. Have you any idea how much this country loses in lost time from employment due to alcohol? So it's not just due to alcohol addiction, but just due to alcohol. It's billions of dollars. It's a lot of money. You don't have that much, I don't have that much, but the country is losing it. I think the need is there to get information, but just having it is not enough. To understand it and understand your own disease, and then to actually act on it. I'm amazed at the number of people that do the first two steps and then sit back. It's sort of like thinking that, well, I've got to prepare a meal and open the fridge and bend your knees and think that a hot meal is going to hit you in the chest. It's not. You've got to actually move it along a bit, do a bit of preparation and a little bit of cooking. Right, let's finish with what are the implications for young people. This is the last one, I think. Yeah. First of all, teenagers have brains that are changing by pruning connections and consolidating learning. They'll learn those things best that they do most frequently. And this is why kids that, you know, get involved in music at that age end up using either being very good at singing, playing the piano or whatever. Kids that are really mad about sport will end up being very, very good at it. Consider the contrast in brain development. Remember I said you prune off the things you don't use. Playing sport versus a couch potato. What are you going to learn as a couch potato? Maybe you know what the next program's going to be, but I don't think you're going to do much for your physical or mental health. What about studying, spending all your time playing computer games? Nothing wrong with computer games, but if that becomes the obsession of your life, and at the stage when you need to get some skills to get into the workforce, that part of your brain's going to be pruned off. It's actually quite recent research, but it has very, very important implications, doesn't it? It's no good at the age of 45 or 50 saying, I think I'll go into an apprenticeship now and I'm going to start studying now. It just might find you've left it a little bit too late. So, going back to what I said before, an adolescent really is somebody with a mature reward system by their mid-teens, but they have to wait until their mid-20s. In order to develop a mature, what we call, control system. The comparisons I made before, the motor car with the turbocharged engine and the dodgy brakes. And at that stage, I would be delighted to finish up and answer any questions if there are any, Fiona.